Amazon is now, in essence, metaphorically burning books. So Amazon is not allowing books to be sold that go counter to the Babylonian system. So any book that goes, obviously, that's more of the evangelical bent, that says marriage between a man and a woman, any type of thing like that that goes against the Babylonian system, that book is now deemed a hate speech book and in essence is burned. Which I mean by that is not literally burned, but they're just excluded from you buying them. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means that you better have books on your shelf now that you want, because you're going to find it in the near future impossible to find certain books that just, you're going to have to go on, eBay or something like that and buy these books or whatever for on the black market or whatever you have to do. But you're not going to get them in a commercial store like Barnes & Noble, Amazon, whatever, wherever you're getting books. And that goes for digital as well. And like I've mentioned before, make sure, that you have backups. That you might have a cloud library on your Kindle, and I do too, and I have Logos, and I have thousands of books on my Logos. But at the same time, I have thousands of books in a physical library too. I have a backup. I have physical books, and then I have my virtual books. Be careful about just having virtual books. I think it's now time that you go and buy hard copies of things. Because if they're doing that, that's pretty scary. Well, I mean, obviously, commentaries and stuff, I mean, there's tons of them. You can get Wiersbe Walvoord, you can get The Knack, you can get Grace Evangelical one, and the list goes on. I mean, I can give you guys a list of different commentaries and theological studies. I would get Theology for Today by Elmer Towns. I would get Ryrie's Theology. I would get all of Fruchtenbaum's materials. I would get Alfred Edersheim's. I can send the list out. And what I would say is, because like some of the things, that I would say the majority of the lists are stuff that you can get free online, but don't count on that. Like right now, like Alfred Edersheim, he's one of the best on the background, the Jewish background of things, okay? So Alfred Edersheim is someone you want in your library. You want all his resources. Now, Alfred Edersheim's resources, because they're so old, there's no copyright on them, so they're free on the internet. But there's going to come a day you're not going to be able to get Alfred Edersheim. So my thing is you get the hard copies of Alfred Edersheim and you make a library. You start building your library. Do not think that you can just simply go virtual. I'm telling you what, you're not going to be able to get access to that, because I can foresee a day where they say, look, all Christian literature is hate speech. If Christian literature, think about this, if any Christian literature says marriage is between a man and a woman, that's hate speech to them. That's what's coming out in the Equality Act. Are you listening to what's happening on this Equality Act? I'm telling you what, you say male and female, man, that's hate speech. You see marriage between a man and a woman, that's hate speech. You believe in the nuclear family, that's hate speech. And so it goes beyond like just perversions. It just goes on to basic family issues. And so we're literally seeing a virtual book burning now. And so my thing is, get your library as fast as you can and make it in hard copies. I just don't trust what, I mean, look what they're doing. Who gives Amazon the right to just banish books? Yeah. And Bill Gates and all these other guys. And, it's just that they think they're the arbiter. Basically, they think they're God in controlling information. And, I mean, that's really, really bad and evil. I mean, that's what Nazi Germany did. That's what communist Soviet Union and China does, is they book burn, and you can't get... I can tell you this. You already know the big book that they're probably eventually going to ban is the Bible. I mean, in every communist regime, the Bible's always banned. We've had it so such a... blessed situation, if you want to call it, in the fact that you can go down to Walmart and get a Bible for a buck. And there might come a time where you can't find a Bible, unless you have one on you, obviously, and you have one in your home. But you may not be able to because these crazy people are already deeming the Bible as hate speech. If they can't twist the scripture enough, they'll just ban the Bible like what China does that, or Russia does that, or any of these communist regimes do that. So yeah, I think, you know, when you see that, one of the judgments of God on a nation is the famine of the word. You can't find it. I mean, for goodness sake, there were several times in Israel's history where they lost the Bible. Then they find it again, and they reestablish it, and they start reading it again. And so there, for a period of time, Israel would go without anything from the Word of God. I think what we're seeing is it's very possible, the longer we're here, that you're going to see this attack on the Bible, and the Bible might be banned, especially with the Equality Act. I'm telling you what, man. They're centering in on the Christianity and Judaism, by the way. And they're going to say it's racist, whatever, xenophobic, whatever. But yeah, it's coming. So think about building a library. I'm not talking about like you have to go out and buy 1,000 books. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about you're going to need legitimate commentaries, legitimate theology books. You're going to need legitimate helps for your family and you. And, you know, what that might mean, like 20, 25 books on your shelf or something like that. Okay. If you got the right resources, that's all you need. It's those who don't. And I'm a little shocked sometimes when I find that a Christian only has a Bible. Because I understand, well, that's all I need. That's the Word of God. It is. But then because you lack commentaries or you lack, like, Alfred Edersheim or Fruchtenbaum, you will lack the cultural understanding of the phrases in the Bible. You can read the Bible, but sometimes you won't know what it means unless you know the background, unless you know hermeneutics, unless you know the cultural sayings, the Hebrew idioms. And so that means you have to be armed with a little bit more than just a Bible. In order to interpret the Bible correctly, you have to have lexical and syntax. You have to know the definitions of things. You got to know the syntax. You got to know the culture. You got to know the history. You got to know all the language, not to a scholarly level, but you have to know there's a certain background behind this. And for anyone just to read the Bible without knowing the background, they're doing yourself a disservice. You can read the Bible for years and still not know what a passage means because you don't know the background. So my thing to you is, I'll give you the recommendations, but you got to get yourself a good set of several commentaries. And when you read these commentaries, it's kind of like eating the watermelon. You have to eat the watermelon but spit out the seeds, because not every commentary is going to be exactly right. You know, it's a commentary. And I'm not saying to rely on it, but you use the commentaries for the background material, for the scholarly, historical, cultural context. Then you got to have, like, I know right now I've recommended a lot of you guys to, like, Blue Letter Bible or other things that help you parse out the Greek a little bit. But what if Blue Letter Bible doesn't exist? What if Study Light doesn't exist? What if all these other search things that you use to parse things out don't exist? Well, what do you have to have then? Well, then you have to have the tools in order to parse out the Greek and the Hebrew. And so you need those other tools, like in your library. And so I can give you those recommendations too. So you need a lexicon, you need concordance, you need Bible dictionaries, you need interlinears that help you parse out things, and the list goes on. Why do I say that? Because what I would like to see everybody in our church be able to do is be independent of technology. To be independent of technology, because they have their resources at home. And no one can take that away from you unless they go bashing through doors and start taking things away. But they can take the internet away from you. And that's what I want you to start thinking ahead about in building your library. I've said this before, but now that I'm watching Amazon do what they're doing, man, that's scary. Other thing I will mention, and this will be the last thing. I did a prophecy update today about the Pope, and obviously you know the Pope is placing his bets to be the false prophet, and he really wants to be the guy, because he's really trying really hard, really hard. So, like, he's in the running. It's him and Bill Gates and I think Hillary Clinton, one of the three. So guess what this guy's doing? And I did a whole thing on Return to Babylon. The Pope is having an interfaith prayer at Ur of the Chaldees in Iraq. So, I mean, Ur of the Chaldees, if you go there and you can look it up online, Ur of the Chaldees has a giant ziggurat there, and there's a lot of ruins there from Ur of the Chaldees. And it's true that that ziggurat there goes to about 1900 BC. So Abraham's about 2000 BC. So right in that neighborhood, Abraham, it's very possible that Abraham did see that ziggurat and the ruins there, and they date back about 1900 BC. Anyway, that's true. That's where Abraham came from. But what's not true is what the Pope is trying to do. I want you to watch this steady pull towards Iraq, because that's where Babylon's going to go back to. Babylon is going to be rebuilt in Iraq. And the scriptures make it very clear that the headquarters of Babylon, where Nimrod built the tower, will be reestablished, and it eventually be the Antichrist's headquarters in Iraq. Now, it's funny that the Pope is pulling people to Iraq, and what he's wanting to do is this interfaith thing is like to bring the quote-unquote Abrahamic faiths together. The Abrahamic faiths do not include Islam, by the way. They want to include Islam. He doesn't. That's a Chrislam thing. Islam is not an Abrahamic faith. Even though they say they follow Abraham, they don't. It's a satanic religion. Judaism and obviously Christianity come from the Abrahamic line. The Christianity is the Gentiles coming from the spiritual line of Abraham by faith, and obviously the Jews by physical descendants of Abraham. So you do have Father Abraham being the father of the Jewish nation and also the people of faith as well at the same time, who believe in their one true God. So that excludes Islam. But anyway, the Pope is putting these three together and also inviting other religions of that area and around the world to come there, to have a kumbaya, and join hands and say we all worship the same God. And he's the front runner on all of this. But he's going there to say, because this is the Abrahamic faith and of all these religions, and I get that. But whether he knows it or not, he's pulling the religions of the world back to Iraq, which in my mind, I'm thinking, oh, dude, you're doing exactly what Zechariah prophesied. So in Zechariah 5, Zechariah predicts that there will be, in the last days, he sees a vision, and he sees two women with stork wings, and he sees an ephah, which would be like what you would put grain inside and you would transport things in. Ephah represents economy, an economy. And then he sees the ephah, and then it has a lead lid on the top of it in the vision. And the lead lid, it's not a lead lid, it's a lead disc. In the ancient world, when you bought and sold things in the ancient world, they would have scales, right? And what people would do to cheat you is insert lead discs on one side to make you pay more, and you didn't know that the lead disc was there. And so obviously you would get less grain and pay more money. That's how the merchants cheated you with discs. Well, the ephah, which is a symbol of economy, has a disc on the top of it, which tells the reader or anyone looking at the vision that the economy is going to have a lead disc on it, which means it's going to be an unjust economy. And you can talk about an unjust economy with communism, Marxism, socialism, because just like when you have a lead disc, let's say you're trading in the Middle East and you're doing the scales, and you slip in a lead disc, you're stealing from the person more money because you're making him think he's got more weight there with the discs. So in essence, a wrong economy steals from people, right? Keep following me. So therefore, any economic system that has as its foundation stealing is a Babylonian system. It's not a legitimate economy. Now apply that. an economic system that steals from people would exactly be what you're seeing today. A communistic, globalistic society, one world currency, all that, you know, Marxism, communism, that's it. So a economic system, but then inside the economic system is a woman. And inside that system, that woman is called wickedness. And in the Bible, typically, she is referred to as the harlot or the whore, the religious whore. And in the book of Revelation, she is the mystery Babylon. She is the whore of Babylon. So in Zechariah 5, the woman in the ephah is put inside the ephah. And then a lead disc puts her down in there. And then the vision that Zechariah says that the women with the two stork wings, the two women with stork wings, made her fly swiftly with the wind in her wings. I'll explain what that means. The wind in her wings, and she was held above heaven and earth as a testimony, and then she was, as a testimony, stayed there until a place for her was made available in the land of Shinar. You know where Shinar is? Babylon. Zechariah is telling you that all of this goes back to Babylon. The Babylonian system incorporates a three-legged stool. The three-legged stool is economics, or the merchants of the world, politics, or the kings of the world, and the religious aspect, the whore of Babylon, which is the world, one world religion. So it's a three-legged stool. In essence, what Zechariah was saying is that this system, this Babylonian system, is going to be escorted to Babylon. And it's a foundation will be made for her there. Now, if you study the vision in more in depth, it gives you a little clue of why it's taken to Shinar. Why is she taken there? Why is the economic system taken there? Why is the world will be ran from Shinar? Okay. Not only does it harken back to what Nimrod did, but the clue in the text is this: that notice that it's two women with stork wings. These are not angels. It's a vision. It's a symbol of something. Two women who have stork wings take her over there. And it has the wind in their wings. Okay, so let's unpack that a little bit. I am not quite sure what the two women represent. All I know is that women in the Bible in that kind of vision represent nurturing. That these nurturing systems, whatever they might be, are doing this for her. They nurture her. So again, maybe that's going to get revealed later on as we get closer to that time. But the wind and the wings represent rapidity. I mean, it's very fast. It's a rapid movement. That they're able to take her and the economic system quickly to Iraq, very quickly, and can get the thing set up very quickly. Swiftness in the wings is what your clue is on that. Notice that the wings are a stork's wings. And what's the big deal about a stork's wings? Well, in the Bible, what kind of bird is a stork? Is it a clean or unclean bird? It's a very unclean bird. You can't eat it. So anytime you see unclean birds in the Bible, they sometimes refer back to demonics or fallen angels. And so in essence, there's a demonic or satanic presence accompanying this system back to Babylon. That's symbolized by the wings. Another meaning of the wings, because they're a stork. I said stork, right? Not pelican. Stork, yeah. I don't know why I keep thinking of a pelican. Stork. The symbol of a stork's wings in the Bible, and by the way, that's where we got the pagan understanding of the stork brings a baby and drops the baby off in March and April. That's pagan, by the way. That's what, you know, that you ever see, we have these symbols of storks when the baby is born? That comes from paganism, because they said the storks would come and drop off the babies in March. Isn't that crazy? And we still have that image today. That came straight from paganism, straight up, man. Anyway, in the Hebrew culture, storks were revered, there's the word, not revealed, revered, for their power in their wings, because they could fly major distances and never get tired. So when you see the stork's wings, it not only represents the demonic, but it represents power, demonic power. So the swiftness of it being brought back to Iraq has to do with demonic power bringing it back to Iraq. But why does it have to be brought back to Iraq? Well, from a theological standpoint, on God's standpoint, everything's going back so that he can destroy it from where it came from. The interesting thing about God is, this is very interesting, if you'll see this theme in the Bible, is that where things begin, God lets them go full circle, and then he pounds it right where it comes back to. Where it starts, it comes back to, and then that's when he judges it. But he lets it go full circle. So with Babylon, he's letting Babylon go full circle, and eventually he's going to destroy it in 1 hour at the very site where Nimrod put it. Okay, from a man-centered standpoint or a demonic standpoint, there's a clue in the text, and it's the last phrase. It has to do with she was held up as a testimony between heaven and earth, and that represents that what she has done is she has violated heaven and she's violated man. In both aspects. That's why she's held up between heaven and earth. And then she's held there until this place is made for her. Well, the way the idea in the Hebrew is that this place is being made for her protection. That's why, there's the hint, the whore and the economic system that will eventually run this planet is taking over there to protect it. Why? Why does it need protection? Why does the economic system that is being set up right now need protection to where it needs to go over in Iraq? Why does the whore, the false religious system that you see right now in front of you happening in the wokeism and all this other junk that you see in the churches or whatever, why does it need to go to be at Babylon to be protected? It could be. That's a good thought. Because I honestly don't know. I don't know. But I do know what it says. It's going there for protection. So your guess is as good as mine. What?
I said basically, as people, as time goes on, the people that are left, they're not going to buy it. They're going to rebel against it.
They're going to rebel against the system. Yeah, good point. Josh. That's right. Yeah, and that's a good point. This is where we're in the realm of deduction, okay? In the realm of deduction, we're trying to piece this together, and Zechariah has given us clues, but he doesn't tell us all the reasons. But I think bringing in these other things, like you guys are saying, it's an area that hardly anyone lives there. It's not like New York. It's not like London or Hong Kong or anything like that. It's densely populated. It's like in the desert. But then you're right. The toes of iron and toes of clay, the national and the global doesn't mix. People are more loyal to their nationalities or where they came from than the global system. Yes, the useful idiots will totally accept it, but most people won't. They will have to be forced into accepting it. So therein lies where I think you guys are on the right path. There could be massive rebellion towards it, and it has to be taken over to protect it. It's isolated. It's a perfect place for protection, right? If you're building a corrupt system that you know people are eventually going to rebel against, because economically, what does the system do? It steals from people, which is Zechariah telling you. They put lead discs in the economy, which means they steal from people. Well, after a while, you keep stealing from people, you're going to have a revolt on your hands. Well, then we'll move the system away from anyone trying to attack the system. It's kind of like what they're doing with the Capitol. They have the Capitol surrounded by an army or whatever, and it's like, well, who are you afraid of? It looks like a third world banana republic over there now in Washington, D.C. It's just total ridiculousness. And I know they're feigning, oh, we're so scared, and AOC's having a heart attack because, you know, they're coming after her and this and that, yada, yada, yada. But they do know that if they push it hard enough, they will have a revolt on their hands, and maybe they want a civil war. I don't know. But even Macron, now I want you to think about this. Crazy Macron chastised America and said, you keep your wokeness to yourself. You don't bring this wokeness over here to France because we see it destroying your country. We don't want that over here. You keep your woke professors over there. Now, when Macron is chastising America's wokeness, you got a problem. You got a problem. Who would ever think Macron would say, keep wokeness out of France? Well, he is now. And so it's weird what's going on in America. But all that to say is, what the Pope, it's coming next week, okay, what he does, that is so prophetically symbolic, and he probably doesn't even know it, to bring, the guy who's pushing the world religion, the main guy at the top of it, and goes to Iraq. I mean, I know a lot of Christians probably wouldn't pick up on that, but you do, and I'm speaking to the choir, and you, that is so significant prophetically because we know where it goes. And he could have chose any place in the world. We're going to have a big kumbaya in London or Paris or wherever, you know, where there's more transportation and there's hotels and, you know, going to have a big thing. No, we're going to have it in the middle of the desert where Abraham was at, in Ur of the Chaldees. I mean, take a look at that on Google. I looked at it. There's nothing there. And he's going to go out in the middle of the desert. It would be like us going out to, hey, we're going to have a church at a church meeting in Death Valley. I'll see you Sunday. Death Valley? Why would I go to Death Valley? I mean, that you would ask legitimate questions. Wait, I don't know, because I like it out there. It's peaceful. Now, I want you to think rapidity. The wind in the wings means that when they do this, it's going to be bam, bam, real quick, and all of a sudden it's up. And you're like, how'd that happen? Well, it's kind of like how Dubai popped up. Remember ever watching Dubai pop up? Go online and go on YouTube and say the development of Dubai and watch what happened within 10 years at Dubai. I mean, a literal city popped in the desert and just out of nowhere. Could they do that now? Of course they could. And then do a secret thing, or who knows, what the underground things, all kinds of stuff. Think about this. It's where the Antichrist puts his headquarters. Now, the Antichrist might come out of Europe. He might eat spaghetti. I don't know. And he very well could be Italian because, you know, that's where Rome, right? So he might be an Italian stallion. I don't know, like Rocky Balboa. But I can tell you this. He might start out eating spaghetti, but he's going to eat hummus at the end, because he's going to put his headquarters in Babylon, which is Iraq. Why would he do that? Why would he leave probably his plush environment? Maybe let's say he came from some plush environment in Italy, just making this up, I don't know. But, you know, or he's on the French Riviera or something like that, you know, who knows? And all of a sudden, I'm going to go into the desert in ugly Iraq. You already went. You busted it, but you're right. Demons don't like water. You know what he means by that? The wilderness area is where the haunts of demons are in the Bible. Every time, where did Jesus go to be tested? Wilderness. Paul goes in the wilderness. All of them will go in the wilderness, going into the wilderness, and they end up in demonic territory. Demons don't like water. Why? The flood. Okay, I saw hands. Ernie. Yeah, they're all coming back. The Europeans are real big on this, Ernie. They have, like, billboards of this. One language, one people, one government. I mean, they advertise it. And you're thinking, those are the three things that Nimrod established and before God broke up the languages. And so that's what they're trying to establish. And I mean, for goodness sake, the The building in Brussels, the UN building in Brussels, was their architect designed it to look like the Tower of Babel, and the top of it's unfinished. And why is it unfinished? Because we're still building it, they say. I mean, they literally took the architecture and made it that way. I mean, it's like these guys are fulfilling prophecy, and they don't even know they're fulfilling prophecy by the things they say and do. It's crazy. So, yeah, it's all coming back, and so now what's happening? The nations are not being nations anymore. They're coming back under one language, one government, just like Nimrod. So it's all coming back. So it's what? With China? I'm not necessarily sure if it is. The way they architect made it in Brussels, it's unfinished. I don't know. That's the parliament of the EU, yeah. Yes, and they leave the 666 seat open. No, that's parliament, the EU parliament. But isn't it funny they leave that seat open? They don't know why. So you guys are guessing the right thing, and I think you're on to something because your guess is as good as mine. There must be something that happens that initiates them saying, look, we've got to get this economic system out of wherever it's at, located, and we got to get it to Iraq. We've got to get the whore, the religious system, out of there to protect her, and we're going to take her into the desert in Shinar. And I think you guys are onto something about this, that most people won't like it and will actually oppose it. And so I think we have a clue from Zechariah. Yeah, some hands over here. Yeah. It's very interesting. And Babylon eventually becomes a haunt for demons and every foul spirit. Okay, well, why do demons not like water? Because Jesus sent the herd of swine into the water, and that was like an extra penalty on them. Most people lump demons and fallen angels together, and that's a mistake theologically. Fallen angels, or the sons of God, the Banaha Elohims, are different than demons. They are both incorporeal spirits. But let me explain where demons get their origins from. Fallen angels are angels, obviously, that rebelled with Satan and fell, and they're fallen angels. That makes them a little bit different than a demon. A demon comes from dead Nephilim. They are the spirits of the Nephilim. And most people don't make this distinction. Banaha Elohims do not want to possess bodies because they have never had a body. They don't need a body. They're always free-roaming creatures that God made. Demons, on the other hand, want possession because they want a body back. And if that means a human or even an animal, they will take it. That's why Jesus sent them into pigs. They prefer to be in pigs too. They don't care if it's an animal. And there's been reports, and I've seen reports about even animals being possessed, and obviously humans are possessed as well. So it does happen. But demons obviously came out of the result of the Banaha Elohim cohabitating with human women and creating a hybrid that was not fully human, but was a half-human, half-fallen angel. Well, when these creatures died, their spirits are free-roaming, and therefore, because they have a fallen angel aspect to them, and not necessarily, they're a combination hybrid, and it's hard to explain. Because of their situation, their spirits are what we call demons. And they work on their parents' side. Their parents' side were the fallen angels, obviously. And they do the bidding of the fallen angels. So demons seek out people to possess. Now comes the water. Why are they afraid of water? Why is it that they don't like water? Noah's flood. Noah's flood wiped out the Nephilim. Okay, now they popped up back in Joshua's day again, and then the Israelites had to deal with them and wipe them out and physically kill them. But what you will notice is that demons, not fallen angels, demons cannot stand water because it's a symbol or it reminds them of their demise. And so when they're with the Messiah, demons, there's a lot of demonic activity when the Messiah is on the ground. And so the demons are, you know, basically saying, are you here to judge us before the day? Because they know that their judgment's coming. And they ask to go into the pigs rather than to be free roaming. Demons do not like to be free roaming. That's an unnatural state to them. They want to possess a body because that's how they were. They were Nephilim that had a body. And so they asked the Lord, and he condescended to do that for them. But he added a twist on it, and he added an extra dimension of penalty to it. He put them in the pigs, but what did the pigs do? Ran off the cliff right there, and I've been to that cliff, and many of you have been in Israel. You can see that cliff right there in Galilee, and they jumped right off into the water. Now, that's an extra judgment on that. But nonetheless, when Messiah explains about demon possession, he's talking about Israel. He says the demons look for arid places. They look for dry places. They look for the desert. They look for the wilderness. He specifically says that. So when you want to get your authority on demons, it's the Messiah who actually tells you that they like the desert area. They don't like being around water. So that's just a natural problem that demons have against water. Does fallen angels have a problem? It doesn't appear so. Therefore, to go even further than that, maybe this is more than you wanted to know, there is an area outside of Israel. It's on the Jordanian side, and it's where the Rift Valley goes up and down Israel. Okay, so you have the Jordan, and then on the east side, we would call that the country of Jordan. But in the Rift Valley, that valley is the Valley of the Travelers. And it was very well known to be a very demonic place. The Valley of the Travelers goes up to Bashan. And Bashan is another hotbed for demons and fallen angel activity. So if you go up to Bashan, what you'll eventually come into is Mount Hermon. And Mount Hermon, according to Enoch, the book of Enoch, is where the fallen angels made a council and decided to cohabitate with women at Mount Hermon and create the Nephilim. And again, the whole point of creating the Nephilim is to mess up the Messiah's line genetic code. So from Mount Hermon all the way down into the Rift Valley, all the way going down as far down as you can in the Rift Valley, is called the Valley of the Travelers. The Valley of the Travelers in the Israelite mind was the gateway to the underworld. Okay, that's where the underworld, that's where you went when you died, that's how you went into the underworld, is through the Valley of the Travelers. Yes, but the gate of hell is located at the top of the Valley of the Travelers at the base of Mount Hermon. So if you've ever went to Israel and they take you to Benias Falls, and there's like a whole rock wall of idols, but then there's a grotto there on the left-hand side, that grotto was considered the gates of hell. That's why Jesus used the phrase, gates of hell will not prevail. He's referring to the grotto. But more than that, it's the encompassing place. The foot of Mount Hermon is one of the most evilest place because that's where the fallen angels decided to do this. And the area of Bashan is where the Nephilim were. That's where Og of Bashan was that Moses and them had to take care of. Og of Bashan's bed was like 9 feet or nine by whatever. He was a giant. When Jesus is on the cross, according to Psalm 22, the great bulls of Bashan surround him. You ever read Psalm 22 and it says, the great bulls of Bashan have surrounded me? Well, it's obvious. At the cross where there's bulls from Bashan that were brought there surrounding him, No. So what is that referring to? The bulls of Bashan then are a reference to demons. Demons from Bashan. And so at the cross, not only were the enemies of Christ were there, his spiritual enemies were there too. He was surrounded by bulls of Bashan, means he was surrounded by the demonic horde on the cross. And so when Messiah takes the disciples up to Benias Falls, that's where he asks them, who do men say that I am? And then Peter gives his statement that you are the Messiah, the Son of God. And at that point, he says, you know, the Father has revealed that to you. But why there? Why state that at the foot of Mount Hermon, at Benias, where the gates of hell were? Why state that there? Because Jesus is on enemy territory, so to speak. Mount Hermon is evil. Bashan is evil. It's a demonic stronghold. And it's like the Messiah went there and said, you tried to prevent me from coming, but I'm here. I made it. You tried to genetically prevent the Messiah from coming and tried to create the hybrids that they did to prevent humans. The whole goal of Satan was what? To make sure he bred out the genetic code of human beings with mixing the code with angelic. Therefore, you couldn't call the Messiah human. The Messiah has to be fully human. That's part of it. He declared victory. No, I'm not. I'm talking about the occasion in the Gospels where Peter declares him to be the Son of God, the Son of El Elyon, the Most High. And him making that declaration there is, you failed. Now, he did say that after the cross, too, in Tartus, to the fallen angels that had committed the act on Mount Hermon. Because he went to Tartus and told them, and he made a declaration, and the declaration is, your doom is sealed, basically. You didn't accomplish what you were going to accomplish. Yeah, the 3 days after he died, yes. He descended to Sheol. Sheol, that place of the underworld. Well, there's four compartments. So he was in paradise, because he said, today you'll be with me where? In paradise. So, but then he left paradise and apparently went to Tartarus and made his declaration. And the only people that, or I'm sorry to say people, the only creatures that are in Tartarus are who? The fallen angels who committed the Genesis 6 problem. Because the witnesses of 1 Peter, I think it's 1 Peter, yeah, 1 Peter and Jude say that that's where he went and that's what he did. He was speaking specifically to those angels that did what they did in Genesis 6. Okay, that being the case, let's go back to Mount Hermon and the Valley of the Travelers. So Messiah makes, Peter makes a declaration on the foot of Hermon that he is the son of El Elyon, the Most High God. He's the Son of God. Which means that the demons know he's the second person of the Trinity. The demons know fully well who the Trinity is. And now the second person of the Trinity is scoring a touchdown on their territory and saying it's all coming to an end pretty soon here. Now, the Valley of the Travelers is interesting for this respect. It's considered, and I probably would agree with this, that that is the gateway from our physical realm to the spiritual realm in planet Earth of the access point down, in, I guess in, you would say, to Hades or Sheol. So this might explain in the Valley of the Travelers why Moses' body is contended for by Satan in the Valley of the Travelers. You remember that scene? If you're a Jude, and try to figure that out and say, I don't understand this whole passage. I don't understand why Satan is wanting Moses' body. And I know what the commentaries say, and they're wrong because they don't understand the Jewishness behind the Valley of the Travelers. They'll say to you that Satan wants the body to make the Jews make it a relic and they can worship his bones or whatever. And that's more of a Gentile understanding of things. That's I get why they would come up with that interpretation, not knowing the background of the Valley of the Travelers. When Moses is buried by God, where is he buried? It's unknown, but it's in that area. It's buried. Moses' body, he gets to see the promised land from Mount Nebo. Do you know that area? That's not Israel. That is Jordan. That is the Rift Valley. And that is the Valley of the Travelers, the gateway to Sheol. So Moses, we don't know where specifically where he's buried, but he's not buried in China. He's not buried in Thailand. He's buried somewhere in the Valley of the Travelers. Why is a good question. Anyone know why Moses is buried outside the land in the Valley of the Travelers? No, the Valley of the Travelers, it has to do with the traveling from this world to the underworld. That's why the name is given to it, because they obviously fallen angels, some demons can go back and forth, and then when people die, they travel down to Sheol. So there's where, hence the name comes from. The Watchers are the fallen angels, the Benaha Elohim, that did that. Not all Watchers did it, but the ones that did are the ones who did Genesis 6. The Benaha Elohim are the Watchers. Now, we have Watchers that are good Watchers, and some of the Watchers are given over to individual local churches. So Rock Harbor has a Watcher, a good Watcher, which would be an angel, but they're specifically given the task of Watcher. What are they watching? Us. For what? They're another witness. They're another witness to the church or for the church and against the church. They're watching. They're watching false doctrine. They're watching people. They watch who's messing around. They know who the unbelievers are. They know the apostles of Satan. And they know who's legit and who isn't. And they're watching. Now, why have that? Because on Judgment Day, for the church, the believers will be judged according, and the watcher will be there to testify to what he saw. Because you have to have an accord of law. You have to have witnesses, don't you? So in God's system, he has witnesses, and the witnesses are the watchers, the angels. Some of them are. Some of them are not watchers. Some of them are messengers. Some of them angels do other tasks. But there are angels who watch, and that's all they do is watch. John, does that help answer that question? I think I answered it all. Oh, we didn't finish Moses. Go ahead. So this is interesting. And again, guys, I don't know all the answers on this. All I can tell you is what I know, and because there's some elements about the contention of Moses' body that I simply don't understand. But I'll tell you all I can understand, because I just don't think we have enough information. Okay. Moses is buried by God in the Valley of the Travelers, but apparently, you know, no human knows, but Satan knows because he wants the body. And so Michael has to get called in and call him down, and basically what Michael does, and what I understand what Jude's trying to do. Jude is not trying to go out into this and teach a full extrapolation of the book of Enoch and teach about the Watchers and the Valley of the Travelers. What Jude is trying to do is explain authority. That's all Jude's trying to do. So he's saying, look, Michael basically is less authority than Satan, but Michael invokes God's authority to get Satan to stand down on Moses' body. So if Michael apparently was taking on Satan one-on-one, Satan has more authority and could take the body because he has more authority than Michael. But since Michael is then operating on God's authority, which is El Elyon, the most high authority, then Satan knows he still has to submit to God's authority on the situation with Moses. Does that surprise you? That Satan would even still submit to the higher authority. Isn't that interesting? I find it amazing that in the spiritual realm, even the demons and fallen angels will abide by authority, but then you go into the human realm and they don't. What's the deal with that? That when even a creature like Satan, who has fallen, Michael still knows he's got more authority than me. Wow. It tells you something that human beings that we just simply are not getting. Because if Satan's willing to stand down, because you would think Satan's rebelling against God, I'm not going to do what God says, I'm taking Moses' body right now. You would think Satan would do that. No, he goes, backs off. Fine, I'm done. He backs off because Yahweh says, back off. Because he knows authority. What is it that they know about authority that we don't know? I'm going to leave it with that one. Let's continue on. There's something they know because, man, even they abide by it. The demons go down before the Messiah and they say, don't do anything to us right now. We know they're totally afraid of him because they know Jesus has this authority over them. So anyway, maybe I'll come back to that. This Valley of the Travelers perhaps has to do with the territory and those who have it, perhaps. What I mean by this is when God scattered the nations, and I'm hoping I can explain this right, when God scattered the nations, he gave the nations over to particular fallen angels, two particular watchers, right? And because they had been worshiping them, he gave them over to worship them. And that became these nations' gods. And what started happening then is because of the nations spreading out, that became their territories. And in those territories is where that particular fallen angel operated. Now, you'll see glimpses of this in Daniel chapter 10, where Daniel's angel that comes to him, perhaps Gabriel, says, I was held up by the prince of Persia. That's referring to a high-ranking fallen angel that has control of a particular territory. And then he says, and Michael had to come and arrest me from that and get us free from that. And then he goes, Daniel, I'm leaving you now, but I'm going to go battle the prince of Greece, which is another territorial fallen angel. So what you start realizing from the Deuteronomy 32 passage that they were scattered according to the nations, that each nation was given over to a fallen angel that they worshiped. This is why when you go to the Yucatan Peninsula and you see the kind of gods they were worshiping, why are they these reptilian, feathered-looking creatures? They're reptilian, but they have feathers. So they're worshiping these fallen angels, obviously. And then he did. And God gave them over to it. But what, you know, and then we talked about this, that God was going to reclaim them back through the nation of Israel. Okay, that being stated, this is where you have to understand the land of Israel and how important it is on the spiritual level. It's just simply not land that God gave them. It is Yahweh's portion. It is his territory. Okay? It's not that God doesn't have access to the whole world. He does. He can. But what's happened is certain territories of this planet have been taken over by these fallen angels. And they have what we call strongholds in these particular areas. Now, Eric was here a couple weeks ago, and he talked about some of the strongholds he sees up there in Oregon and Washington. We know that there's probably something there that holds that place in a stronghold. There's probably a lot of demonic activity, and I would agree. In the Pacific Northwest, there's heavy, heavy demonic activity. Okay. So in the Valley of the Travelers, since this is the gateway between Hades and our world, guess who typically travels up and down through it? Satan. And fallen angels and whoever. Now, here's the deal. Moses is buried in a territory that is traveled up and down by demons and fallen angels and whatnot. He contends that Moses should not be buried there. He wants the body. And what does he want to do with the body? He doesn't want the body there in the territory. He doesn't want it there. Why? He doesn't want it there. But it possibly could, and again, this is where I'm jumping out into speculation, because at this point, we're in speculation, okay? But we have to do deduction in order to speculate correctly. I'm not saying I'm right or wrong or anything like that. It is very possible that having Moses' body is an affront to Satan and an affront to the demonic realm, and therefore, they are contesting to God that Moses be buried there, and they're accusing Moses that he does not have the right to be buried there, which basically what God is saying by burying Moses there in the Valley of Travelers is he's sending them straight directly to paradise. That's the messaging, okay? That if God buries you in the entrance to the paradise, that you're just instantly going there, instantly. So it's possible that Satan is contesting that he be buried there because of Moses and his actions. And what would that be? The accuser of our brethren, of the brethren, does what? Yeah. Satan, possibly, again, I'm speculating, is contesting that Moses be granted entrance into paradise based on what Moses did through his life. And what does he accuse Moses of? What did Moses do? Murder, number one. He struck the rock twice. There was times when you didn't protect the holiness of God. There was times where you didn't circumcise your children and your wife had to do it for you. And on and on and on. So, it's possible that the contesting is he does not have the right to enter into paradise. Mm-hmm. Let's take the phrase hell out of the whole conversation. Not two passageways. An entrance. One entrance. But if you go into the one entrance, there's four compartments. Yeah, very well. They think they can win. There's no doubt about that. They're monomaniacal about this. I know we're getting in uncharted water, and this is not something typically you would get into on a Sunday morning. This is what you get into in your theology classes in seminary. And what I'm trying to leave you with is I don't know the full extent of what happened there. But there's something bigger that went on. And there's stuff that we apparently are grasping a little bit, but there's more that meets the eye. Yeah, there's the paradise portion. There's Tartarus. There's the pit. And then there's the bottomless pit. So those are the four compartments. Now, paradise is empty now. So no one's in paradise anymore because everyone who believes in Messiah goes to heaven now and not to paradise. They were taken with Christ at the ascension. So paradise is empty. Tartarus contains fallen angels from Genesis 6 that committed the DNA problem. The pit is what we consider hell, where unregenerate humans go. And the bottomless pit is where demons and fallen angels are temporarily confined. I know, but why in the Valley of the Travelers? So God did it, right? So that's the messaging, right? So, and Satan didn't like the messaging. So yeah, so you're making a good point because from God's standpoint, he's planting into Satan's territory his people. That's why I'm trying to bring this out because the background cultural, like what you're talking about is Second Temple understanding of the Bible. And everybody at that time knew the Book of Enoch, everybody. And that's why Jude quotes it and some of the phrases you see in the New Testament are from the Book of Enoch. Now, the Book of Enoch is not canonical. It's not. It doesn't pass canonicity. But is it a valuable resource to know how they thought? Of course it is. And to what they believed about the Watchers and Nephilim. Yeah, you better believe it is. It's basically Second Temple source information about what they believed. And I can tell you this. The Christians back there believed way different than we do. Now, I'm not talking about faith. They always believe that. But the background of understanding the spiritual warfare, demons, fallen angels, their views of things are completely different than the average church today. And the average pastor who knows the Second Temple background. To know the New Testament, to understand the background of the New Testament, you have to know Second Temple literature. That's the only way you're going to know the cultural understandings and the idioms. And so you're making a good point. Why isn't it taught? What do you think why it's not taught? Do you think they like to have these kind of conversations? No, they do not. They do not, because it makes people feel very uncomfortable. It makes people feel uncomfortable. Because when you get into that kind of supernatural things, most people are not mature enough to handle that kind of level of supernatural activity, and it freaks them out. It scares them. Because they're going to go home and realize they have watchers watching them. And not just good watchers, but bad watchers. And so you go home tonight and you're thinking, okay, I'm laying in my bed at night and I'm all alone and something is watching me. And it's like that song by that one guy, "Somebody's Watching Me." Yeah, you're right. A watcher is. And that's not a comforting thought to think about. People like to, you know that God's watching them, but they don't like to think about demons sitting there watching them. So let's make a practical application of that, just what you said. You're going to go home and you say, I don't know how the Valley of the Travelers applies to me. Well, that was interesting stuff, but and stuff I probably never heard, but I don't know how I live that out. I'll tell you how you live it out. It comes down to the understanding of authority. That's what you take away from the Valley of the Travelers and Moses and Satan's realm and all that stuff. What is it? Well, it appears that spiritual authority is the fabric of the spiritual realm. And in order to operate correctly in that spiritual realm, you must obey the rules of that spiritual realm, especially in authority. And apparently demons, fallen angels, even Satan understands that fabric of the spiritual world. Well, guess what? We're not only in the physical world, we're in the spiritual world as well. And therefore, when a believer does not submit to proper authority, when an unbeliever refuses to submit to authority, whether it's God's authority, the Bible's authority, guess what that makes them vulnerable to? It makes them vulnerable to the demonic for attack, for establishing a foothold, for establishing a beachhead in the person to control the person. So how, when you study Satanology, which I don't expect anyone to have to do, but when you study it hypothetically or you study demonology, what you will learn about possession, oppression, suppression, influence is that the person always steps out of authority and then that's when they're hit. Every time. The person will be hit when they decide to go against the fabric of what God created, authority. So if you have a troubled person in your family and they're very troubled and you don't know how they got there, I can tell you this. At some point, they decided to step out of authority and say, I'm doing things my way. And that's it. And at that point, a beachhead is established in them. The demons say, aha, he's mine. Now, when you talk to demons, not that I'm saying you will, but when you're in a possession situation and you have the demon actually talking back to you, the demon will actually, if you ask them, how did you get control of this person? They will tell you how they got control. And because of that, that person opened themselves up. Now I'm talking about demon possession. That's like way down the line. But when they're at that level, the demon will tell you, he gave me the right to do this. So they're looking for the opportunity for someone to give them the right. And that way is done by not submitting to authority. Whatever that authority is. Rebelliousness is as what in the scriptures? Witchcraft. It is as witchcraft. When someone starts rebelling, they're opening themselves up to have demonic activity, believer or unbeliever. So the takeaway then is to understand how important submission to authority is. So when a teenager rebels against his mom and dad, what do you think? He's opening him or she's opening herself up to problems. And I'm not saying it's all got to go fully possession or anything like that, but it can start with influence, a strong influence in their head that puts something in their head and they start going this way all of a sudden. You're like, what's going on? Well, because they're rebelling against authority, the demons say, aha, that's our cue. And they will take full control of that person if the person is not submitting to authority. And you know what they say? And I read case studies. The demons will actually say, they gave me permission. How did they give you permission? Because they wouldn't submit to authority. That's the application. Because God's given them the freedom to do it. Because they couldn't do it without his freedom. So what you're seeing with God is he's given them, they're on a leash, so to speak. They're rebelling, no doubt about it, but they can only go so far. But Satan is being used, whether he knows it or not, and the demonic realm, fallen angels, are being used by God in this human drama. And we're being used at the same time to prove something to Satan and the fallen angels as well. So God is allowing both sides to rebel, fallen angels and humans, to prove to the other side something. So what is God proving to us through Satan? Yeah, go ahead. And I cannot think for a moment, you know, that once he decided to come out of the authority of whatever structure he was under, RZIM or just God's authority, right? The authority of the Bible. When he made that decision that I'm above the rules and I can do these things because I work so hard for God, he stepped out of authority. Boom. He's influenced now and he's thinking crazy. And he really apparently never came back from that. Now, David did that, but he came back. And people can. But when God chastises David, it's funny the way the Hebrew goes. It says that you have nullified my laws or something like that. I can't remember the English, but the Hebrew is important. The Hebrew indicates that David stepped out of authority and stomped on the law of God. That's the way the Hebrew says, and it's a total act of rebellion when he took Bathsheba. But he says, you have negated or nullified my law, and the Hebrew says you stomped on it, which is not obeying authority. He wouldn't obey it. And at that point, what happened? He did what he did. He got influenced by that. So the takeaway, I don't know if there's any questions about that, and I had no intentions of going down this path at all. We were supposed to study Romans. I don't know what happened, but it is what it is.